When the disciples reached the other side, they had forgotten to bring any bread. Jesus said to them, "Take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees." And they discussed it among themselves, saying, "We brought no bread." But Jesus, aware of this, said, "O men of little faith, why do you discuss among yourselves the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive? Do you not remember the 5 loaves of the 5,000 and how many baskets you gathered? Or the 7 loaves of the 4,000 and how many baskets you gathered? How is it that you fail to perceive that I did not speak about bread? Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees." And then they understood that he did not tell them to beware of the leaven of bread, but of the teaching of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. This is the first of these incidents I want to look at, to look at these prejudiced unbelievers, people who couldn't see what was obvious in front of their own eyes. Chapter 16 starts off with these Pharisees and Sadducees coming to test Jesus, asking him to show them a sign from heaven. Now what they're really saying is, we want you to perform some miracle, some sign, something that will show us unequivocally, undoubtedly, that you are the Messiah. And Jesus isn't going to satisfy the curiosity, because he's already done enough signs. Anybody with 2 eyes in his head can see that Jesus is what he claims to be. Jesus has gone around healing the sick, giving sight to the blind. He's raised the dead. He's done all sorts of things, which is evidence to anybody that this indeed is the one who came from God. But they're not satisfied with that. They want him to actually satisfy them with a specific sign, say a few specific words, and then they say, "We'll believe." Now, I'm sure that even if Jesus had done it, they still wouldn't have believed. But Jesus was not going to do a trick, some sort of magician-style trick, simply to satisfy them. And so that's why he comes back at them and says, "Can't you see the evidence and draw your own conclusions?" He says, you look at the sky and you can say it's going to be a certain type of weather. You look at me, why can't you again draw the conclusion as to what it all means? When he says the signs of the times, one of the problems is, of course, that we have used that expression so often that it's become just a part of the English language. It's one of the signs of the times. But when Jesus used it, the signs of the times referred specifically to the miracles that he was doing. He's not talking here, incidentally, about the return of our Lord or the end times or anything like that. He's talking about the signs or the miracles of the time in which he lived. That's in verse 3. And then in verse 4 he goes on to say, "An evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign." Now you've already had signs in these times. You've already had miracles. You want another miracle. But can't you see the miracles I've already done? Can't you see the evidence before your eyes that I am indeed who I claim to be? So I'm not going to do a special sign just for you. You'll get a sign that will be unequivocal in due course. And that sign will be the sign of the resurrection. That's the reference here to Jonah. Elsewhere, Jesus expands on that. And he says that as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the insides of the fish, so the Son of Man will be in the bowels of the earth, and then after that he will come back to life. And so the resurrection was going to be the sign above all signs to prove to anybody that happened to be around that this one was indeed the Son of God. Declared to be the Son of God by the resurrection of the dead. That's a common sort of a theme in the New Testament. But you can see how these people are so typical of unbelievers who will find any excuse. You've met people like this. If he's really God, I want him to stand here in the room in front of me. You know the sort of person? But they still wouldn't believe, I'm sure. They'd say, "Oh, it's an imposter." You can't win with some people. And Jesus was not going to satisfy their curiosity when they refused, point blank, to believe what was already offered to them through his whole life and ministry. So as they're going across the lake in the boat, they're fossicking around in the boat there, feeling a bit hungry, and they suddenly realise, goodness me, they said, "We forgot to bring any bread with us." Just an offhanded comment. And Jesus picks them up, and he says, "Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees." They said, "What's he talking about?" They said, "Maybe he's criticizing us because we brought no bread. We brought no bread with us." You see, they missed the pun.
Jesus was actually picking them up on the bread thing, just make a little bit of a pun out of it, and said, you're worried about the bread, you want to be very careful about the leaven, particularly the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees. Oh, they said, he's upset with us because we didn't bring any bread. Jesus said, look, I'm not upset with you because you didn't bring any bread.
Look, he said, can't you remember what happened when they had no bread once before? 5 loaves, 2 fish. He said, I made it into enough bread to feed 5,000. I fed 70,000 on another occasion. That really isn't the issue. The fact that you don't have much bread is not any great concern to me. He said, I'm trying to get a point across to you. So then he said, look, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. I'm not talking about a particular type of bread that they make. They must have thought, yes, we're allowed to eat ordinary bread, maybe, but not bread that's baked with Pharisees' leaven. So we should be careful at the shop we go to next time to make sure it's a proper kosher shop and not a sort of Pharisee-Sadducee shop which is selling the wrong sort of bread. No, says Jesus, that's, goodness me, you've got the thing wrong. And he explains that I'm talking about the teaching. Oh, that's what you mean, they say. And at last, the penny drops. Just coming back to this leaven thing, I suppose it's better to use the word yeast. We don't talk about the word leaven much these days. But I think it's worth reminding ourselves that the word has come into common usage, mainly in the church, I suppose, when we talk about the leavening effect. And so something can have a leavening effect for good or a leavening effect for bad. Because leaven, or yeast, was something that was put into the dough to make the bread rise. It originally was made, I understand, by them taking a little bit of the dough and putting it aside until it fermented. Then when it had fermented and started to do its job properly, they could put it into the dough, and so it would do its job in permeating the dough and working through the whole loaf. I think it was that reason, this association with corruption or fermentation, because of that, leaven was forbidden in the sacrifices of Israel, so that if any bread was offered in any sort of sacrifice, it had to be unleavened bread, because leaven tended to spoil. Therefore, the bread had to be of a type without leaven, so that there was no risk of any corruption or spoiling coming into the offering of the sacrifice. Consequently, it developed a meaning as symbolizing evil, because it spoils things, and a little evil can spread right through a thing. So the saying developed, a little leaven can leaven the whole lump. And Paul uses that expression when he writes to the Corinthians, and he says, you've got sin in your church. A lot of sin in their church, actually. And they hadn't dealt with the problem. And he said, if you leave this sin unchecked, it will spread right through the church, and it will affect the whole of the church. So you've got to cut it out, a bit like cutting out a cancer. If you leave it there, it will eventually move right through the body and work its evil effect everywhere. So you've got to get the whole thing out so that it can no longer do its nasty work. Likewise, leaven. He said, if you leave this leaven in your church, if you leave this sin in your church, it will corrupt the whole church. So you've got to take it out. And the particular characters who were guilty of some very heinous sins, he said, you've got to remove them from the church so that their effect is no longer felt. If not, if you just leave it go, you'll find the whole church eventually gets corrupted. He then moves them back to the Passover, the original Passover, when the people of Israel were leaving Egypt, and they had to get rid of the leaven out of their houses, so that the Passover was always eaten with unleavened bread. And one of the reasons was that as the people were travelling along the road out of Egypt on their way to Canaan, they had no time to cook their bread with leaven. So as they hot-footed it out of Egypt towards the Red Sea, they had to cook their bread in baking pans as they went, carried on their shoulder, and they'd be cooking the bread. But it was just flat cakes, unleavened bread, because you had no time for all the fancy stuff being cooked in an oven. It just had to be the straight unleavened bread. From that time on, the Israelites ate unleavened bread at the time of the Passover. And so Paul says to the Corinthians, Christ, our Passover, has already been sacrificed for us. It's more than time that you fellows got rid of the leaven out of your house, meaning the church. And so you can see the sort of symbolism of this meaning that leaven has in relation to sin. That's, I think, the way Jesus is using it, the leavening effect. Things corrupt. Mind you, there is one place in the Bible where I believe it's used in a good sense of the effect of the gospel going through the world. And that's a common expression, that the leavening effect can be good, that a thing can have a good influence and spread. But here, it's a bad influence that spread. And he says, you've got to be careful because of this corrupt teaching, this corrupt influence of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And if you're not very careful, you'll be corrupted too. They don't believe. They have a wrong approach to the law. All their teaching is upside down. And you've got to take stock. Otherwise, you'll be affected by it. Beware, he says, of the leavening effect of wrong teaching. Now, I think that's a good warning for us as well. Because we live in a society which likewise has a whole range of teachings floating around. I'm not thinking of the church in particular, I'm just thinking of society in general. If we think we are not affected by the general tendencies in society, then we deceive ourselves. Inevitably, we're affected to some degree. You know the sort of thing, the lowering of standards, where we don't bat an eyelid now at things that used to shock us 10 or 20 years ago. And so, slowly but surely, we're softened up to accept things that are less than perfect. It goes through the philosophies, it goes through education, it goes through business, it goes through family life, it goes through everything, really, the whole of our society, this sort of leavening effect of the spirit of the age. I think we should take Jesus' warning ourselves. Beware of the leavening effect of wrong teaching, of wrong attitudes. Don't let ourselves as Christians be influenced by the substandard morality of the world. And when Jesus explained this to them, they then grasped that he was talking not about a particular ceremony of the Pharisees and Sadducees, but of the leavening effect of their wrong teaching. And if you go across to Mark chapter 8, you have the same story with a slight variation. Mark chapter 8, verse 15. The setting is exactly the same. It's the same incident that's being referred to. But in verse 15, he cautioned them, saying, take heed, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. Just a little extra there, the leaven of Herod. Not only the religious influence, but also the secular. Herod, of course, being the governor. But when you look at the particular issue concerning Herod, it seems to me to be not much different from the one that we have concerning the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Namely, a person who refused to believe the evidence in front of him. A person who wanted a sign. He wanted a specific sign to prove that Jesus is the Son of God, that he is the Messiah. Now, do you remember when Jesus was brought before Herod at his trial? He was first of all before the high priest, and then they marched him around to Herod. And Jesus didn't say anything to Herod, but it says Herod was hoping that Jesus would perform a sign. Exactly the same. It's the same problem as the Pharisees had. Give us a sign. Do a miracle. We want to see you perform your tricks. And then we'll know that you have supernatural power. And Jesus again refused to perform a sign to convince somebody who seemed incapable of accepting the plain evidence that had already been presented to him. And if you just flip back a page, we'll see a little bit more about the leaven of Herod in chapter 6, Mark chapter 6. The previous story talks about again how Jesus was doing mighty works. What mighty works are done by his hands? In the opening 3 or 4, 5, 6 verses of chapter 6, it talks about some of the signs and wonders that Jesus had done. You come down to verse 14, and Herod heard about it, for Jesus' name had become known. And some said, John the Baptizer has been raised from the dead. That's why these powers are at work in him. Others said, no, it's Elijah. Others said, no, it's a prophet, like one of the prophets of old. And when Herod heard of it, he said, oh, it's John whom I beheaded. He's come back to life. It's amazing, isn't it? He wouldn't believe that Jesus was doing these miracles, but he will believe that a character whose head he'd chopped off has actually come back to life and is walking around the place. I don't know what he must look like when your head's been stuck back on after you've already been beheaded and buried and all the rest of it. But somehow he thinks this fellow's come back to life and been stuck back together again, and he's walking around doing miracles. Now that strikes me as being a far more unlikely thing to happen. I mean, that's a pretty preposterous idea to believe. But Herod is prepared to believe that rather than believe that this man is Jesus, the Son of God. God in the flesh, as Jesus claimed, walking around here, revealing the Father and doing the Father's mighty works. But people don't want to believe that. And so they'll believe the most preposterous idea, that here is a beheaded character, head stuck on, wandering around the place doing miracles. Now, today we have the same thing.
You've met this sort of thing where people say, oh, I don't believe in God, I don't believe in all this in the Bible about miracles and a virgin birth and all that type of thing. And then you'll find them believing the most weird things about occult practices. And they talk about the stars, how this is going to, the stars are going to make it all happen for them. They talk about how this is going to happen tomorrow and the next week. And I saw this fellow and he'd done something else. And some of them have got the most outlandish stories. And they believe them, apparently. But when it comes to believing that Jesus was the Son of God and that he was what he claimed to be and that the miracles he did were actually true, oh, I don't believe those fairy tales. And yet they believe something far more preposterous. Absolutely incredible, the lengths people will go to. You see it again, people who deny the spiritual. We don't believe all this Christian stuff about soul and spirit and go to heaven and, you know, all these Christians, they're all a bit out of date and they'd believe anything. People will poo-poo the Christian position. And then the very next minute, you find them talking about Aboriginal spirituality. Or they've been to some tribal group in the Amazon, or they've been to some other tribal people up in Asia somewhere, and they say, oh, the deep spiritual meaning that these rocks and things have. And they talk with all the seriousness of somebody reciting the creed at the altar. You know, they really take a serious... And yet the very same people will rubbish the Christian notion of spirituality. They'll refuse to accept the most obvious evidence, but turn themselves over backwards to accept something that is really not very credible at all. I've met people in other countries who say, oh, we don't believe in a God, this idea of a God that created the world and this idea that he lived in this world and that Jesus was God. We don't believe all that. How can a man be God anyway, walking around here? And the very same people will be bowing down, worshipping a hunk of rock. Well, surely it's much more likely that a man would be God than a piece of rock would be. But they'll worship rocks and trees and images and idols and statues and things that they've made. And you think that is totally irrational and unreasonable and unlikely, but they'll do it. You go on and on with these sorts of examples, exactly the same as Herod. They will not accept the evidence in front of their eyes that Jesus Christ was what he claimed to be, that the miracles he performed were evidence of his divinity, and yet they will believe anything else. They'll invent miracles, they'll invent supernatural happenings, anything rather than believe. And that's prejudice, that's the prejudice of unbelief. And it just stops people. Here it is a stopping Herod. He was a man who simply refused. He was stubborn, that was his problem. You know the story, I think, of Herod, how the girl asked for something. Then it goes on to talk about how John came to be beheaded because Herod gave this girl her wish. He realized after he had agreed, after he made his promise, he realized he'd done a stupid thing, but he dare not go back on his word because he'd lose face in front of all the people. And so it says in verse 26 that he was exceedingly sorry, but because of the oaths and his guests, he did not go back on his word. He didn't want anybody to think he was a wimp, and so he executed a righteous man. It would have been far better to have gone back in his word. At least he would have saved himself from being a murderer. Nothing to be proud of that you break your oath either. But it's surely a lesser sin than murdering an innocent person as he did with John. And so that was part of the problem of Herod. Didn't want to change, didn't want to give up. And here again, now he doesn't want to believe. And so he doesn't want to believe here about the miracles of Jesus. You get into the story of the trial of Jesus. Again, he doesn't want to believe about Jesus. Always demanding the sign rather than accepting Christ for who he was. There's one more story I'd like you to just flip over to. It's in Luke chapter 12. It's not a story so much as just a reference. Luke chapter 12, verse 1. In the meantime, when so many thousands of the multitude had gathered together that they trod upon one another, Jesus began to say to his disciples first, "Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy." So there's another meaning now to this leaven of the Pharisees. We saw previously that it was teaching, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is their teaching. Now he says it is their hypocrisy. And then of course there's the leaven of Herod, which again was his refusal to believe and his stubbornness. When he talks of hypocrisy here, it's not necessarily the sort of hypocrisy that we might talk of today. It's partly like that. We say a person's a hypocrite when he says one thing and does another. Well, that's true. And that's true even in the Bible. But the particular emphasis on the word hypocrisy in the Gospels is a person simply putting on an act, play acting. And these Pharisees are really play acting. They are professing to conform to the details of the law. And you know how finicky they were over keeping all the details, that you had to tithe even the grains of wheat and count off the grains and then push every tenth grain aside just to make sure that you're exact. And all this exactitude in the minutiae of the law, but they omitted the weightier matters of the law. And here are these very people who are making out their God's people and at the same time plotting how to kill Jesus. And time and again, through the Gospels, you see that they were plotting to kill Jesus. And they apparently didn't see that that was also against the law. Murder, one of the most obvious transgressions and one of the most serious. But it didn't even occur to them, apparently. And so all these evil things are working within them. And that again is what leaven does. That's again what evil does, you see. It distorts people's value system so that they overemphasize the unimportant things and totally overlook the major things. And that again is what was happening with Jesus all the way through, that they were overlooking what he was doing. They couldn't see that this man who raised the dead, who healed the sick, who comforted the sorrowful, who forgave sinners, they couldn't see that he was the Son of God. They said, oh, but he can't be the Son of God because he doesn't wash his hands properly. Or he does his healing work on Sunday, on Saturday, as it was for them. I mean, he heals people on the Sabbath. Can't possibly be a godly man. The fact that he healed somebody didn't occur to them. All they saw was that he did it on the Sabbath. They got the whole thing skew-whiff. Everything was out of kilter. Hypocrisy. Play-acting. Making out that they were very godly and very concerned for righteousness, at the same time wanting to crucify the Son of God. So there you have it. Some of the problems of prejudice, which reinforce unbelief, which confirm that unbelief, so that people cannot see the plain evidence before them and will accept anything else instead. What are the warnings for us? Let me just summarize by reminding you of the two points that I've been trying to make. One, we should not be stubborn, but we must accept Christ for who he is, what he claimed to be, and what he did. That's the first thing. The second thing, don't let the thinking of the age distort our thinking. Beware of the leaven of the age. It infiltrates, it permeates, it goes right through society, it goes right through a thing, and everything it touches, it turns to its own way. That's what yeast does, that's what leaven does, as it goes through the lump of dough. That's what is happening in any society we live in, whether it's in the society of Jesus' time in Palestine in the first century, or whether it's here in our society today. Don't let the world influence your thinking. Be not conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, and then you will know what is the good and acceptable and perfect will of God.